Hello and welcome back to our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2025 in partnership with Agria, covering the life cycle of the horse and all the key stages they'll go through. Today we are teaming up with our partners Dodson & Horrell and NAF to take you on a deep dive into the nutritional needs of our horses across their lifetime and how these might change as he ages. Joining me to discuss this, I've got two nutritional experts. First up is Kate Hoare. She is the head nutritionist at NAF, where she's worked for nearly 28 years. A registered equine nutritionist, she's a member of the British Equestrian Trade Association's Feed Committee, secretary of the European Workshop on Equine Nutrition Association, and has been widely published on a variety of nutrition topics. Welcome, Kate.
Hello, Rachel. Thank you so much for inviting us. Looking forward to this afternoon's talk.
And we are very much looking forward to see what you're going to teach us. And joining Kate and myself is Dr. Margot Mass, a veterinary and nutrition advisor at Dodson & Horrell. She has been a vet for nearly 10 years, with seven of those spent in equine practice, both in the UK and in Europe. Her role at D&H involves helping the team and their customers with technical information and product advice, providing marketing support and responding to nutritional management queries. Welcome, Margot.
Thanks, Rachel. Glad to be here.
We are delighted to have you. So first off, when we are talking about equine nutrition, what are sort of the key principles that we need to be thinking about when it comes to our horses?
Well, I think it's really important to remember the horse as a horse, remember where they've come from, remember their evolution as a grazing animal, typically grazing around 16 hours a day. So really thinking about that digestive system that relies on fibre forage trickling through all the time. We can look at some specifics of how we tailor that to different needs as we go along. But I think it's always worth remembering the horse is a horse and this is how they designed to eat, and sticking as closely to that as we can.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I would like to add as well, always remembering about ensuring access to fresh water at all times, because it's easy always to focus on forage first, which is how it should be as well, but actually we could argue that water comes before forage even. And then in terms of the approach to feeding, really, is thinking about the horse's condition and individual needs, thinking how we can feed the horse according to their body weight and workload, especially thinking when we think about the workload, I think it's important to remember that we should feed for the work that the horse has done, not in anticipation of the work that the horse is going to do. And then, yeah, just trying to stick to regular routines. Horses thrive on routine, and maintaining regular feeding times, and ensuring, as Kate already mentioned, that feed and forage trickle throughout the day in smaller amounts more often. It's definitely one of the rules for digestive health when it comes to feeding horses. And in that line as well, I would also add that any dietary changes should be made very gradually. So we always suggest or advise a minimum of 10 days for hard feed transitions, and then any forage changes should be made over the course of 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's really important, isn't it, Margot? Because particularly one of my favourite areas is considering the microbiome of the hindgut. And that is why it's so important to make those changes gradually, because the microbiome is adapted and specialized to what the horse is eating. If you make a dramatic change to that, even sometimes from one bale of forage to the next, if it's different, then the microbiome can react in quite a negative way. And that's when we see disturbances to the digestion, you get loose droppings, you might get, you might get condition change if it's extreme. So yeah, making changes gradually, that's one of the golden rules for sure.
Yeah, because it is, equine nutrition is quite different to human nutrition. And I think it's in the way that we can anthropomize our horses and their personalities and things, we also possibly can do the same when we're feeding them. And we think very much about, you know, as people, we have, say, three meals a day and the odd snack, the odd being a bit more than it should possibly if I'm sat at my desk for too long. But I think, as you say, the fact that the horses are supposed to be having that fiber going through their system pretty much constantly is a very, very important thing and a very key fundamental, and one that sometimes we aren't always as good at doing as we maybe should be, particularly maybe if horses are stabled.
And it is a balance because so many of our horses are naturally good doers, and therefore ad lib forage can cause a problem with unnecessary weight gain. So we have to look at how we balance the need to trickle graze with the need to control that weight gain. And already, Rachel, we're getting off into a whole different subject of obesity in horses, which is probably a separate webinar altogether. But it is one of the biggest challenges, I think, for horse owners to balance their management regime, whether that's fully turned out or whether it's partly stabled or whatever it is, to balance the management regime with the need to trickle graze, with the need to control weight gain. That is a big challenge, but there are ways we can help with that.
There are. And actually, you mentioned a whole separate webinar. We did two on equine weight and obesity for last year's Equine Health Week campaign. So you can find those episodes wherever it is you found this one, whichever podcast platform you prefer, and make sure you listen to those. We've got one is with nutritionist Ruth Bishop and the other is with the Horse Trust. So they are
perfect.
Some really, really interesting, really accessible and some great strategies in there to help you if you do have a horse who holds their condition maybe a little bit better than they should. We've mentioned there at start particularly that the nutritional needs of the horse are going to change throughout their lives. What might those changes look like if we're sort of the whole point of this week is we are covering the life cycle of the horse. Could you, between the two of you, maybe give us a bit of an overview as to how those changes are going to happen as the horse's life, how we can best tailor the nutrition that we're giving them, the strategies we're using to make sure they're getting what they need at each specific time?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of those questions where you kind of like almost don't know where to start, really, because you could start by how you feed a youngster. But then again, do you start when they are weanlings, or do you go actually all the way back to their nutrient supply in utero, so when they are still in their mother's bellies? So if we take, for example, if we approach broodmare nutrition, again, that could be the topic of an entire different podcast probably, but there is ongoing research in the field which highlights that the entire pregnancy is a prime opportunity to maximize the outcomes, health outcomes, that is, for both the broodmare and her longevity and fertility, as well as the health of the foal once they are born. So I would say, in general, we tend to stick to baseline or maintenance energy and protein requirements up until the fifth month of pregnancy, unless that broodmare has specific health conditions, such as gastric ulcers or any reason to control her weight in either direction, etc. And then from the fifth month, then we start gradually increasing the amount of calories, so energy and protein. And specifically, we look at micronutrient supply. So that would be vitamins, macrominerals and trace minerals. And I think this is something that it's important to highlight. It's not all about simply increasing the feeding rate from sort of the halfway point of the mare's pregnancy, is actually rather increasing the nutritional quality of her diet, because there is also evidence to support that if mares get to the foaling date carrying excess weight, that predisposes to both problems during foaling, so that what we call in veterinary terms a dystocia or a complicated birth, as well as potentially causing the foal to be too heavy at birth again. And also, depending on the mare's metabolism, which will be linked to her breed, her age, etc., and also individual characteristics, she might find it more or less difficult to lose weight once the foal is born throughout the first couple of months of lactation. So again, having the mare maintain a good body condition score throughout the pregnancy, it's crucial to then ensuring that fertility on the other side. I don't know if Kate, would you like to add anything else in terms of the micronutrient supply?
Yeah, it's a really exciting time for, you know, particularly for those involved in breeding. And actually, we would take it back one step further, because there's some interesting research, and actually some research we've been doing on some novel formulae of ours in terms of preparing both the broodmare and the stallion for reproduction. So we can start even before the new foal is a glint in mummy's eye. We can start sort of right before helping the broodmare prepare for oestrus and prepare for reproduction. There's some recognized nutrient pathways that we can help her with. Similarly with the stallion, things like omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin E, selenium, the natural vitamin E being the preferable. So those we like to recommend starting sort of 8 weeks before for both the broodmare and the stallion. In order to get them into their prime performance, if you like, because it is a form of performance once they come to stud. And then, yeah, for the broodmare, very much a individual variation. Again, we need to look at how she's performing, particularly in those latter stages of pregnancy that Marga mentioned. Some mares absolutely will benefit from a stud feed. Some may just want a balancer to make sure they're getting those vitamins and minerals. Some may do very well on the grazing, but again, we need to make sure that the vitamins and minerals are provided. So that's where we would use perhaps a supplement for the broodmare. It's worth remembering that the spring flush of grass that those of us who own good doers and such like, we're a little bit afraid of this really rich grass coming through. The reason it is so rich at that time of year is because it's designed to coincide with when the foal hits the ground and the mare's peak requirement, or the other way around, which came first. So many brood mares, particularly the good doer, the pony mares and such like, they won't need additional feed as such, because the grass itself is an additional feed at that time of year, but they absolutely will need the vitamins and minerals, because modern pasture is not the Dr. Green that perhaps we think it is. You know, we've got multiple deficiencies in our pasture across the UK. So whichever end of the scale your mare is at, you know, she may need a stud mix, she may just need a broodmare supplement, but she will need those vitamins and minerals.
And if we pick it up from here, again, with the focus on the quality protein, vitamins and minerals, we can maybe then talk about the weanling stage. So weaning is probably the most stressful episode in a youngster's life, in a short youngster's life so far. There is a little kind of slump in growth rate associated with that stress from weaning. And that usually happens within the first 2 to 4 weeks after the youngsters have been weaned. And at that point, really, their growth rate is pretty much at their highest. And then it starts to slow down. So they basically, it's not that they stop growing, it's just that they grow a little bit slower when they hit the yearling mark compared to during the first sort of 6 months to a year. And that is where, again, we want to focus on the quality of the diet rather than necessarily the calorie or energy supply. And as Kate was saying, we typically wean those youngsters when the grass in our fields is at their best quality. So we can sort of count on it as a very reliable source of energy and protein to an extent. But that's when, again, a stud balancer can come in really handy because of those deficiencies that Kate was talking about. And I think one important word of caution at this point is to talk about developmental orthopedic diseases. So this is an umbrella term that encompasses a group of diseases, including OCD, as well as other malformations of tendons and ligaments. And even though it is a multifactorial problem, so it can't just be blamed on nutritional deficiencies, there is a genetic component, there is individual risk, exercise also plays a role in either facilitating the development of these diseases or preventing them. We know that nutritional imbalances can be part of the problem. So in that case, we talk specifically about imbalances or deficiencies when it comes to the supply of calcium, phosphorus and copper, as well as supply of amino acids, especially key amino acids for musculoskeletal development, and crucially, excessive weight gain in growing horses. And again, if we think about the context of summer pasture and then those youngsters being fed either a standard horse and pony nut, for example, or even some versions of stud muesli or stud cubes, which might have an excess supply of calories for them at that stage on top of the pasture, that can predispose to excess weight gain, which then again predisposes or increases the risk of these developmental orthopedic diseases. So a stud balancer, which is a low calorie, low starch, low intake, concentrated source of protein, vitamins and minerals without the extra calories or the extra starch, is the perfect solution for those 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, absolutely. Just making sure they've got those vitamins and minerals in a balancer or in a supplement in a really concentrated form. And another thing, it's interesting to think about at this sort of stage, from that sort of youngster through to early riding stage and onwards, we're often asked, you know, when do you start a joint supplement on a horse? And many people will be thinking, oh, well, he's 12 now. Perhaps I should start a joint supplement. He's 14. Actually, there is evidence to show that if we protect their joints early on in life, then we're protecting their joints through to maturity and beyond. So particularly for performance horses, you know, for youngsters aimed at the performance market, particularly perhaps for these larger warm blood breeds and such like, we would be starting them on a glucosamine chondroitin type product pretty early on, just at a maintenance level, just, you know, we don't need to go over the top, but just making sure they're getting some targeted joint support in there, because it's actually never too early to start, almost. And it's certainly, there is evidence to show that we should all be starting that much earlier than most of us consider it.
Yeah, so sort of before the horse is bolted type situation.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Actually, that evidence goes back to in utero. You know, there is evidence to show that if you supplement the broodmare, then actually the joints of the foal are better. But that runs through into the youngster and into the growing youngster as they come into work, particularly with, you know, the warm bloods and the larger breeds.
No, that's a really interesting point, and one I'm sure many of us haven't considered. How about the adult horse then? What should his diet be looking like?
Well, I think as Marga mentioned earlier, feed to work done, that's really important. That's a golden rule of feeding. So look at your horse's exercise level at their performance level. And let's be truthful about it. You know, there is some evidence, and we all do it. I'm sure I'm as guilty as anyone. There is some evidence to say, oh, you know, horse owners tend to think that their horse is working harder than it actually is. And it's really important that we're honest with ourselves about that, because feeding a horse to hard work level when actually he's in medium or even light work, it's not going to make him a superstar performer. It's going to make him overweight. So yeah. it's a bit like saying, you know, if I eat a Mars bar, will it help me go out and run a marathon? Well, only if I'm training for a marathon. If I'm lying on a sofa, then it's just going to help me get fat. So I think assessing what level of work the horse is in is really, really important. And I'm sure Marga's got some pointers on making sure the feed is right for those different levels.
Yeah, we'll touch on this later. I think absolutely agree with you, Kate. There is kind of this tendency, at least in my experience with individual and group horse nutrition, to overestimate the amount of work or the level of work, and then underestimate the horse's body condition score, which is another important point I think we should make when it comes to just general adult horse nutrition. I think every person responsible for feeding a horse, whether they are the owner or not, should be familiar with body condition score, muscle score, for certain breeds or certain individuals more at risk of obesity, as well the Cresti neck score, which is a good indicator
really
as well.
Useful.
So we can point, we can signpost the audience towards guidelines on this on the show notes, because I think, you know, if you've never practiced scoring your horse on these points is something that's very useful to do. And I don't know, Kate, your opinion, but perhaps even more useful than actually knowing the horse's body weight. Of course, we want to know the body weight, you know, at least roughly, you know, from the point of view of accurately feeding that horse, dosing medication, dosing warmers, for example. But when it comes to really following the outcome of the diet, the body condition score and the muscle score for working horses can really tell you pretty much what you need to know, really, in terms of, are you feeding the horse appropriately or not?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's nothing beats just standing back and having a good look at them and saying, yeah, because apart from anything else, body weight will only tell you, you know, tells you weight, particularly if you're on a weigh bridge, which is the most accurate way. What it doesn't tell you is how that weight is distributed around the body, you know, so it might be muscle, it might be fat pads, it might be, you know, so body weight only tells us so much. I do think, and I do recommend to people, that having a weigh tape is really useful. I always say, with the caveat that they are notoriously fairly inaccurate, particularly at either end of the scale. So particularly for the smaller ponies and the very large horses, those weigh tapes are relatively inaccurate. But what they are is a really good guide, because a guide to change. Because again, as owners, it's really difficult for us to see a change in our horse when we see that horse every day. So I tend to advise owners to keep a diary. And once a fortnight, maybe once a week, no more than that. You don't want to be looking at daily changes. Once a fortnight, take a weigh tape score. And if the same person uses the same weigh tape at the same time of day, then you will see any change over time, because it's really easy to miss that change over time if you're seeing that horse daily. So yeah, some form of monitoring, getting your hands on, can you feel the ribs? What does the neck feel like? That's important as well. So we'll help you with pointing at some body condition score templates.
Definitely. We will include links to those on the Equine Health Week 2025 hub on our website, which you can find at www.britishequestrian.org.uk, along with any of the other resources that we mentioned, both in this episode and across the week as well. So make sure you check those out, because body condition scoring, very, very important, as both Kate and Marga have said. As our horse is starting to age, then, we've obviously mentioned the fact he should probably have started joint supplement a bit earlier than that. But what else do we need to consider as he gets a little bit older? Maybe his workload is changing. He's starting to feel his age a bit.
Yeah, I think there are... We should talk about the differences between lifespan and health span. So, of course, we now keep horses in good health for longer than we've probably ever done before, thanks to better veterinary care, better nutritional care, etc., and just a better overall understanding of them, really. But regardless, there are changes associated with aging. So, there is a decrease in their nutrient absorption capacity. And there is also changes in terms of intestinal permeability. So not really necessarily going into the leaky gut syndrome, which is a clinical condition per se, but there is changes associated in terms of the gut's capacity to hold nutrients within and then transfer those nutrients into the bloodstream. We also should consider changes in dentition. So over time, as you know, horses' teeth wear and change shape, and that may change their capacity or their ability to process and chew different types of feed, and then their diet should change accordingly to those changes. They might also become more susceptible to stress. again as they age, and that can be related also to their susceptibility to infection, especially if we enter the PPID territory, which is again a clinical condition which carries an increased susceptibility to infection. And then again, nutritionally related to this, we should consider the age-related diseases. So PPID we mentioned, but also EMS, osteoarthritis, which Kate already alluded to. And in a lot of ways, the role of nutrition with regards to these diseases is contributing to the prevention or the delay of the onset of the problem, as Kate already mentioned, for the joints. So there's many things that we can kind of enhance or improve when it comes to immune response, weight control, hoof health, joint health, et cetera, et cetera. So these are kind of like the things that we kind of are at the forefront of our decision making.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Margaret. And I think, again, I know we tend to end up sounding a bit like a stuck record when we talk about nutrition of horses. But just standing back and having a look at the horse and saying, how is he doing? How is she doing? I think it's really important, and I'm sure Margaret would agree, to not feed to a number. You know, just because they've reached the magic age of 16 doesn't mean we need, a change of feed. They may well be doing perfectly well on the feed they're doing, they've had all their lives, and actually there is some evidence to show that drop off in nutrient absorption and the drop off in digestive efficiency, it actually happens much later than most people think. So we sit, and again it will depend on all sorts of different parameters. Sometimes we might think, well, the horse is going to lose a little bit of condition because they're getting a bit older. But actually, that may coincide with when they're stepping down in intensity in their workload and their performance. So suddenly they gain a bit of condition. So it's really important to look at that individual. Often they keep their weight very well until in what we call the veteran stage, which takes them through to early 20s. And actually, that weight loss associated with age may not happen until the geriatric stage, which is sort of mid-20s and onwards. And the PPID that Margie just mentioned as well, that's Cushing's syndrome. Clinical condition you need to talk to your vet about, but I would encourage people of older horses to make sure they're having that conversation with their vet, get the test done. It's more common than we think. The incidence within the general population, equine population, is round about 3% of the whole population, but that goes up to over 20% in horses over 15. So once you've got that sort of late teenage, it's worth thinking, well, why are they a bit duller than normal? Why are they not quite themselves? And have that conversation with your vet. And then the diet can certainly support alongside that. You know, we can look at some herbal support, we can look at digestive support and such like alongside what your vet's offering. So I would say make sure you get that checked out, because the early signs of Cushing's are not the classical signs. You know, they won't go straight in with the curly coat. So the early signs are signs that are very often put down to, oh, he's just getting old. You know, it'll be the coat looking not quite so good as it did. It might be a slight behaviour change. And actually, there's something going on there that you can have a conversation with your vet about.
Yeah, definitely. Look out for things like drinking more than usual, having recurrent hoof abscesses where, you know, in previous seasons that didn't used to be a problem, things like that, or in even alterations or changes in their regular appetite or demeanor. Can, especially again, as Kate said, in that over 15 years of age population. And I think, again, we're talking about veteran horses here, but we it's a recommendation that would apply to pretty much any age, would be to know what your forage looks like. Mm-hmm. So again, recommending here at least once yearly forage analysis. Depending on where you get your forage from, you might be able to have access to nutritional analysis from the supplier. But otherwise, there are plenty of options to have the forage analyzed. Yeah. So most feed brands in the UK offer a forage analysis service. So you can reach out to your feed supplier and get that organized, and that provides you kind of like with a baseline in terms of the horse's diet, and again for these older horses particularly important to consider what the forage contribution is in terms of starch and sugars, particularly sugars, as well as overall energy content, digestibility in terms of the fiber and type of fiber proportions, etc., because that can be again, going back a little bit to the beginning and the and what Kate was saying about the horse's microbiome, that can be a crucial intervention to support the horse's microbiome. And the microbiome is linked to, again, nutrient absorption, gut health, but also immune health in the horse. So knowing that you're feeding the right forage, you might be feeding, I don't know, a ryegrass haylage, for example, but it might be better that that particular horse is on a soaked meadow hay, for instance. But you won't know that until you have a nutrient analysis, and there's no way you can know what that analysis would look like just by, you know, looking at the forage with the naked eye. So I think that's something that's important to consider. And again, also in terms of the enhancing fiber intake in these horses, particularly when we enter the stages where maybe their dentition is not in tip-top condition, is thinking that all fiber contributes to forage intake. So nowadays we have many options for high fiber feeds, either chaff-based or just feeds with a high fiber content that could come in a cube format or even in a coarse mix format. So look out for those. And again, consider as well that all the fiber in those feeds contributes to their forage intake.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, that it's so easy to over concentrate on what we're putting in the bucket, and actually the forage is the biggest part of the diet, or certainly should be the biggest part of the diet. So that's really good advice. And just on as we're sort of hopefully giving you a few tips on what you should be aware of and what to look out for, another one I like, linked almost inexplicably linked with forage, is to know what their poo is like. Okay, so know what is normal for your horse. Know what the number, the colour, the consistency. I apologise to anyone who's eating while they're listening to the podcast. But actually, we talk about the three C's of count, colour, consistency. Know what's normal for your horse, because if you see a change to that without a reason, you might see a reason. For example, if you go to put your horse on the lorry, you might suddenly see an increase, you know, in production, and that's quite normal. But if there's a lot more or a lot less, or the consistency changes, anything like that, if you see a change without being able to know what that change is for, then it's definitely an early warning system that the microbiome is not happy. And as Marga said, the horse's microbiota is part of their largest immune system organ. You know, the gut is really the largest immune organ in the body. It accounts for certainly over 70, possibly over 80% of general immunity. So we must ensure that we're keeping that microbiome happy and the gut settled.
Very good point there. I say, hopefully no one eating their dinner, but it is a very important thing. It's as you say, it's a very early indicator and a very obvious indicator sometimes that there is a problem there that we need to look at. And obviously this is probably quite a good point as well to flag that obviously we've given you a very, very whistle stop tour through this sort of life cycle of the horse and the feeding at different stages. If you need any support at any of these points, pretty much all the feed companies will have a team of nutritionists and a helpline who can help you find the right products for your horse, you know, even just sanity check what you're already giving him and make sure that you are giving him exactly what he needs and the best possible source of nutrition for him. So pick up the phone. Some of them have got online chat lines as well, or email addresses, whatever works for you, and reach out and see. Just double check, as I say, sanity check what you're doing. Right. We talked about all of this and we talked about what we should be doing. If we're getting it wrong or the nutrition isn't managed correctly, what are some of the kind of the key problems we could see in our horses?
Well, I think we just mentioned one there, change in digestive health, and whether that's a change in the droppings or a change in condition. You know, if we get the coat suddenly looking dull, if we get a drop off in condition, anything like that will show that there's a potential issue. Also things that sort of behavioural changes, things that typically we may have referred to as stable vices, but now we more correctly call them stereotypic behaviour. So if we're seeing anything like crib biting, box walking, sensitivity to the girth, you know, any sort of, oh, he's just a bit grumpy. You know, horses aren't just a bit grumpy. They're telling us something. So any change in behaviour and change in how they look and their appearance definitely sign that something has upset the digestive system. That may be from the stomach. It may be the hindgut. But something's not quite right along that very important tract within the body. Would you agree, Marga?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think, again, there are some conditions that nutrition can aggravate, certainly. So we discussed already, you know, the fact of overfeeding starch, etc., in youngsters, or even, again, also in that population of horses with the insulin dysregulation that could be across horses with EMS, with metabolic syndrome, or with PPID. But I think, if we kind of like try to stick to general rules of feeding to promote health here rather than create problems, I would, aside from what Kate already said, I would only suggest that ideally horses should have less than 1 gram of starch per kilo of body weight in every feed in order to support gastric health, metabolic health. So this is a bit of an odd calculation to make, and I appreciate not everybody is really ready to make it. But again, many feed companies will be absolutely happy to do that calculation for you if you are worried that your horse might have an excessive starch intake. And again, this is absolutely not an attempt to demonize starches whatsoever. Starch is a fantastic source of energy for horses, but again, it's all about being starch aware rather than starch allergic, so to speak. But yeah, knowing that kind of threshold for health reasons, trying to also avoid feeding more than 2 kilos of hard feed per meal. That would be for a 500 kilo horse, or of course it would be less for smaller horses, because again, that carries a higher risk of upsetting the stomach of the horse. So trying to stick to smaller meals more often, which again, we already mentioned it at the beginning of the recording. And yeah, just really like knowing this kind of principles of prioritizing fiber, knowing what your forage looks like and whether it is appropriate for that horse. And ultimately, it's a bit of a compromise because you're trying to think, is the feed plan for this horse as close to the ideal as possible? And that's really the goal. But then you have to kind of marry that with the circumstances that might be that the horse is on a DIY livery yard, so you only get to go there once a day. So then that's where really understanding your horse and partnering with someone who can provide you with the right advice, whether that's a feed advisor from a feed company, or again a feed advisor from a supplements company, or a vet or a horse nutritionist, will help you really make that feed plan as ideal as possible for the circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really good advice on the starch. Of course, we've touched on performance horses. Horses will need, so if horses are at that higher rate of exercise, they will need additional energy. So if we're looking to manage the starch intake, keep it to that 1 gram per kilogram per meal, then one way we can get extra energy in if we need to is with additional oil. So oil is a really good way of feeding additional energy to the performance horse, or to the equally suitable to the older veteran horse who may be dropping weight and you want to manage their starch intake. Oil is a great, really metabolizable, easily used by the body form of concentrated energy. Important to introduce it gradually. You know, we're over perhaps 6 weeks, 8 weeks, up to the level that you want to be feeding. But a high oil diet is fantastic for some of these performance horses, particularly where they're looking at stamina and things like endurance and eventers. The high oil diet is great at fueling that diet without you know, without contributing to the problems of excess starch. And so that's another way we can look at the broader diet. If we are getting into the realms of high oil, then we just need to balance it with vitamin E. But generally people are feeding vitamin E alongside oils. And we could get into a whole other conversation about which oil is best. But looking at a high oil diet is a good start for those performance horses who need additional energy but don't want high starch.
Great advice, Kate. I would just like to add that for the vitamin E supply, again, very crucial, especially for horses that where you introduce an oil. You will find oils in the market which already come supplemented with a vitamin E. But otherwise, just make sure the horse either gets enough supply of that vitamin E either through their feed or through a supplement.
Through a snip.
So yeah, the general rule of thumb is 1 international unit of vitamin E per added milliliter of oil in the diet. So you basically just look at the supplement or the feed label, and you should be able to work that out because it's 1 to 1 milliliter. But yeah, definitely something to bear in mind, especially if those horses don't graze enough or they don't have pasture turnout to get their vitamin E supply.
Very good point. So I'm walking into a feed store, and there is this vast array of bags in front of me of all shapes and sizes and colours and brands. What key information do I need to consider when I'm choosing which one of those bags is the right one for my horse? And we've talked about some of these factors already about feeding for the workload and things like that, but what should I be thinking about?
Well, I think the approach here is, again, if we think about in a kind of like in a pyramid way, so the base of that pyramid would be forage, so that's both pasture and preserve forages. So we've talked about these already, and how to decide or what that looks like for a particular horse. And then you should think about your compound feeds, so that would be your hard feeds, your balances, and your supplements as additional sources of energy and nutrients. So you should consider really that individual horse, their age, their work level, any specific demands in terms of health conditions, such as are we managing a horse with gastric ulcers? Are we managing a horse with metabolic syndrome, et cetera, et cetera? And then that will kind of like guide your decision in terms of is it a hard feed what's required? So that would be the case, for example, for horses in medium to hard work, they will have a hard time meeting their calorie needs just with a forage and a balancer or a forage and a supplement diet. So that's where in this group you would really reach for a hard feed. That generally it will be pretty easy to choose because most feed brands market their feeds with a name that already gives you a clue of the indication of that feed. So generally, you will kind of have an idea of whether it is a really high energy feed or is it a more moderate energy feed, depending on what you're looking like. And again, it's mostly to do with the kind of like the level of energy in that feed and the and where is that energy coming from? Is it mainly from starch or cereal sources? Is it mostly from fiber sources? And then really, it comes down to preference, I would say, whether you go for a coarse mix or a muesli or a cube feed. Generally speaking, cubes tend to be slightly lower in starch than the muesli equivalent of the formulation. It can also be interesting if you have if you're feeding multiple horses and some of them are a bit more picky, you know, then you know the pellet or the cube version doesn't really give room for the horse to really pick and choose. So you kind of like make sure that everything goes in that sense. And then if you are feeding a horse on a, you know, light to perhaps moderate workload, or maybe they only work a few days a week, etc., then perhaps you don't need that extra energy that the hard feed would supply on top of what already the forage brings. And that's where a feed balancer or some supplements that come already with a sufficient supply of vitamins and minerals can be the perfect complement to that forage. So again, it comes down to the individual horse and the preference of the owner. Because again, going back to the being realistic with the feed management is a decision based on how often are you going to be at the yard, or who is in charge of feeding the horse, how individualized that feeding can be, or does the horse need to be fed the same as everyone else on the stable, or the same as another horse from the same owner, etc. So these are all things that kind of like come into play. And again, whether it's a balancer or a supplement, it will generally be branded or marketed already, so that you have an idea of which kind of horse is it formulated for. So is it a young horse that we need to kind of cover growth as well as workload requirements, or is it an older horse where we are trying to you know, just cover more that veteran requirements? All of that the feed and supplement companies have already done that work for you. Probably a worth something worth noting would be if you are feeding straight cereals, which is not necessarily something that is common practice, but some people like to feed a straight cereal alongside their forage. So that would be plain oats, for example, or barley or wheat. None of these will be what we call nutritionally balanced. So you can't necessarily count on a forage plus straight diet as supplying all the profile of amino acids, vitamins and minerals that the horse needs. So again, that's a situation where you would need additional vitamin and mineral supply from either a balancer or a supplement to make sure that the all the minerals and the vitamins are in the correct ratios, which are not necessarily in cereal grains. Don't know if Kay, do you want to add anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've covered it really well there. I think the straights, you know, the definitely are nutrient deficient. I think that also applies to those people, you know, the those horses who are good doers or in very light work and they're on that forage only diet. You know, there are plenty of horses who throughout the grass growing periods, but also over winter when they're on preserved forages like hay or haylage, they're doing very well in terms of their body condition, because that can, for a light requirement, that can provide sufficient energy for them. But what it can't provide is a balanced diet. So no hay or haylage is fully balanced. You know, we touched earlier that grassland and soils are becoming increasingly deficient, and actually that's a whole climate change conversation that's washing nutrients out of our soil. That is true of our grass. It's even more true of our forages, because forage loses some of that benefit of the grass. Vitamin E is a good example. Marga mentioned earlier that if the horse is on fresh grazing, they're getting their vitamin E as soon as they're on hay or haylage, they're not. So, and you know, that's just one example of several. So if they're on that forage only diet as well, they definitely need either an appropriate balancer or a supplement. And then Rachel, I think you talked about just how do we choose? There might be half a dozen chaffs to choose from. There might be three or four different horse and pony feeds to choose from. How do we know which brand to go for? Obviously that's personal preference to a large extent, but there are some guidelines we can help you with. The first one I would say is, do you know the company? Do you trust the company? It's a truism of many industries. If that company has been around for 30, 40 years, chances are they know what they're doing. Chances are they're doing a pretty good job, you know. So don't always immediately reach for the latest new kid on the block, because they might not necessarily be actually as relevant or as up to date with the nutritional needs as a company that's been around for 30 or 40 years. So simply, do I trust them, is a good start. And then there are certain things you can look for the competition horse. Beta NOPS approval is really important. So NOPS stands for naturally occurring prohibited substances, and it's an audit scheme that those manufacturers of us, both feed and supplements, those of us who are signed up to that scheme, we are committed and we're actually obliged to do regular testing on all of our ingredients, right from what field they were grown in, right through to sort of delivery to your feed store. It's a tightly controlled process to limit the risk of naturally occurring prohibited substances. And by prohibited substances, we're talking about things like caffeine, theobromine, morphine, things that are actually relatively easy to get into the feed chain. You'd be surprised. So it's really important that those companies have the right tests in place to make sure that product is suitable for competition. If you see a feed or feed supplement absolutely guaranteeing 100% safe to compete on, contains no banned substances, you know, 100% guarantee, then our advice would be don't go near them with a barge pole. Because any company that is offering you a guarantee, they don't know the risks. They don't understand the risks, because if they did understand the risk, they would never offer a guarantee. And actually, it's a condition of the NOP scheme that none of us offer a 100% guarantee, because we know that we can't do that. We know that the risks are there, and so we have to take all those steps to minimise them. And the NOP scheme has been recognised as massively reducing those positive examples within feed and within performance and within racing. And actually, for the leisure owner, for those of you know, I'm a fully paid up member of the Happy Hacker Brigade, so I'm not so personally concerned about a positive test because I don't really compete. But actually, I still think the Beta NOP scheme is a good thing to be looking for, because only the companies with the best quality audits can get beaten ops. You know, you have to have really good quality standards in place in order to qualify for beaten ops. So even if your idea of performance is a 2-hour hack on a Sunday afternoon, and that sounds great to me, by the way, even if that's your idea of performance, it's still worth looking for that Beta NOPS logo, I think, because it just gives you the confidence that the product has been produced to a really high quality level. Would you agree with that, Margaret? Anything to add to that?
No, absolutely. I think you've summarized it so well, and thank you for that. I would say, again, when you are at the feed store and you feel a bit overwhelmed at the choice, again, on top of everything we said already, just take some time to look at the back of the feed bag or the look around the supplement tab or bottle and check for that Beta NOPS logo, which will reassure you that the company who manufactures that product has been accredited. And again, if if we talk about performance horses, it's all about the marginal gains, isn't it? Because sometimes those horses' diets are already so optimized, and so much of it of their performance relies on that adequate nutritional management, that then it would be such a pity and such a sad state of affairs if they were to be eliminated from a competition or have a result invalidated because of a positive doping test to a NOPS substance. So again, I always encourage the riders, the professional riders that we look after, to really trust only accredited brands for their horses' feeding, because it's not really worth the risk.
Exactly. Absolutely. And also it's a welfare thing as well, I guess, because the reason those substances are prohibited is because they're going to have an impact on performance. They might mask problems or cause the horse to compete in a way that he wouldn't otherwise.
Exactly.
So it is a big welfare consideration as well. And obviously you don't have to be competing, though. Those principles will still apply even if you are just hacking and schooling at home. Obviously we want our horses to be in the best condition when we're riding them, mentally and physically.
And just one last brief thing on the beta NOPS. If you are competing, we mentioned that that none of us can offer a 100% guarantee. These positives do happen, thankfully very rarely, and thankfully beta NOPS minimizes the risk, but they do happen. It's just the nature of the ingredients that we all use. If you are using a beta NOPS product in both your feed and your supplements, and you can show that, you know, if the worst happens and you can evidence, well, look, I've got a beta NOPS product, that the company that involved can immediately check their retained batch sample, and the FEI will see that you have done best practice. And actually, that is being taken into account now in some of the trials we're seeing. You know, if you can show that you put best practice in place, and actually this was a genuine, unfortunate contamination, but it's nobody's fault, everyone did the best thing they could, then the FEI do take that into account, and you are seeing, you know, you are seeing different results dependent on what type of product they chose, what type of feed they chose.
And I'm sensing here that we might need to do a whole episode about this clean sport and NOPS, because it's a really interesting subject, and there's so much we can do to make sure our horses are, as I said, competing as fairly and with their best interests as well. So yeah, maybe we'll hold that one for the future, and we'll do one on that, because I think it would be really beneficial for everyone. We've talked a lot about feed there, and we've talked about a lot of the things we have talked about will also apply to supplements as well. Are there any other considerations maybe for choosing a supplement and making sure that our horses are having what they actually need and not anything unnecessary, or, you know, we're just throwing things in because our friends on the yard are feeding it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we sometimes get people ringing us saying, well, I'm feeding a joint supplement, I'm feeding this and I'm feeding that, and I'm getting an oil and I'm giving them some apple cider vinegar, and I've got a probiotic, and what else do I need? And at that point we normally go, whoa, back up. You know, so yeah, we are certainly, I am a big believer in keeping things simple and keeping the diet to what that horse needs, you know. So if they're having the recommended level of their concentrate feed or their balancer, then they don't need a broad spectrum. They probably, you know, if they're competing, we recommend a joint supplement for pretty much any competition horse. And electrolytes, we've talked about so much this afternoon, we haven't touched on electrolytes, but really important for all competing and working horses as well. So we would say joint supplement, electrolyte. Thereafter, what does your horse need? You know, what is their need? And try not to double up. We wouldn't be recommending a broad spectrum vitamin and mineral if they're on a balancer. You know, we don't need to do that doubling up. You're actually very unlikely to feed a toxic level. We're lucky in the horse world that there is a huge gap between required levels, recommended levels, and toxic levels. So it's unlikely, unless you did something really extreme, it's unlikely you would get to that position. But you could just be wasting your money. you could just be feeding more than you need. So we would say, look at the whole diet. We always ask people, what's the rest of your diet? What other things are you on? So yeah, have a look at the whole thing.
And again, this is where coming back and speaking to the nutritionist is the really beneficial thing to do. As you say, they will set you on the right course. We've done a very whistle-stop overview of a lot of subjects, and we openly acknowledge that there is a lot we haven't discussed, and we could have been here all day. And quite frankly, I'd have found that quite interesting because I love all this nutrition stuff. But if people do want to find out a bit more about some of the things we've talked about today, where are the resources available that they could do that?
So we have recently launched the DNH Members Club. So this is a new initiative where we bring together the horses and everyone who loves horses. So you actually don't need to have a horse to be a member. But if you do have a horse, then actually your horse will be a member of the club. So there is now a new section on the dotsonandhorrell.com website. It's called the Members Club. So here's your invitation to go online and sign up. And that will be our platform where we will eventually centralize all of our knowledge sharing, guidelines, best practices, any snippets of the life of our ambassador riders around the world, interviews, all of that good stuff. For the moment, many of our blogs contain already very useful information, and those still live on the dotsonandhorrell.com website, so that's a good point to start. And in line with what Kate said, I would also encourage everybody to visit the beta website as well, because there are a few useful posters and kind of like cheat sheets on some of the points we touched on.
Yeah, absolutely. And similarly, our website has our articles and blogs, and also obviously keep up to date with us on all the socials. You know, that we have a great team, and actually more of our inquiries probably come through socials than they do the. It seems crazy to be calling email old fashioned these days, but we welcome inquiries in all of those areas. We've just actually opened a WhatsApp number as well for inquiries, and we'll be doing live chat shortly as well. So, but again, in terms of articles and blogs, both from myself as nutritionist, but also from our vets, Andy and Sean, there's some good information. Again, the beta website is a good starting point. The FEI have online information, and they have sort of training tools you can work through as well that give you a bit more information about feeding and nutrition as well. So if you want to sort of do a bit of self-guided training, that's quite a good area to go as well. The bottom line is, if you want some more help, if you need to reach out, then give us a ring. We've all got helplines. We've all got nutritionists, hopefully, on those helplines who can give you some advice. And we are horse owners and horse lovers ourselves, so we will give you the best genuine advice we can.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. And we will include links to all of those that we've mentioned, as I've said already, on the Equine Health Week 2025 hub on the British Equestrian website, which is www.britishequestrian.org.uk, where you can find everything that has been covered across the whole week. There's loads and loads of really good information there covering every life stage of your horse. All the podcast episodes will be embedded there as well, if you can't find them on whichever platform you choose to listen to on your podcasts, and also all the social media graphics and things as well. And yeah, check it out. There's loads of really good stuff there as well. Before we sign off, has anyone got any sort of parting message that they want to leave with our listeners?
I think just listen to your horse, look at your horse, see what they're telling you, and if you need any help or advice, get in touch. We're always happy to help.
Yeah, I would 100% second that. And I would just add again that we are lucky that in this day and age we have a breadth of knowledge at our disposal, and a lot of companies, reputable companies, that are willing to become your partners to make sure that you feed your horse to be their healthiest and happiest.
Brilliant. Thank you very much both to Kate and to Margaret. We have had a really good chat here. Hopefully everyone listening has got some things to take away, some nuggets of knowledge that they can help use to improve their nutritional journey, whatever it is they're doing with their horse. So thank you very much both. I hope you've enjoyed being here with us today.
Very much so. Thanks very much for inviting us, Rachel.
Thanks, Rachel.
And thank you very much to everyone listening at home. We hope you will join us soon for yet more Equine Health Week 2025 podcasts. See you soon.